If psychology and pop culture had a baby, they'd call it the Shrink Tank Podcast. Our illustrious panel of shrinks analyze and psychoanalyze what's happening in entertainment and pop culture. Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Verhagen. I'm a psychologist, an author, and a bad magician. And right across from me is Rachel Kitson. She's a psychologist and also our media darling. She's written still the most popular articles ever on shrinktank.com. Rachel, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. Frank Gaskell is a psychologist. He's also the author of the Max Gamer graphic novel, and he's our resident insane person. And Frank is almost always upset about something, either for good or bad. Frank, what are you upset about?
I'm not upset. I'm scared today.
Oh, you're scared.
There are ground troops in Syria, and it's really bothering me. I was talking to somebody about how Putin was really brought up in the KGB, and there's this whole idea of putting more and more stress and never letting up. And I'm starting to freak out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's messed up what's happening.
This is something that would freak you out on any...
I'm regularly thinking, wait, but how's this ever going to end?
Yeah.
So there's that.
So there's that. And also Jonathan Hederle is a counselor. He's a critic and he's our sarcasm all-star. Jonathan, you've got some stories that you've been following this week. Give us a few.
Sure. The first one comes from parenting.com. It's 10 ways teens are hiding their online behavior from parents. So apparently there's a 2012 teen internet behavior study, and they found a few interesting findings. Among them, teens ages 13 through 17 spend an average of 5 hours a day online, while their parents actually think they're only spending 3 hours. And even 8% admit to hacking other people's email accounts.
I will tell you this, I spend nearly every session with families about this issue. And the list in the article is clearing the browser history using proxy servers. There's always going to be a way that kids can get around this stuff. And the conversations really need to begin when the kid is 4 years old or 5 years old and starting to game. And then you have this open communication with your child so that it's not a secret. I feel like it's less about the technology and more about the tenor of a family and the kind of conversations you're having.
Yeah, I mean, if you only have these conversations about what they're doing wrong and you keep trying to close the loopholes, that's going to be a never-ending... I mean, that's just inviting kids to exploit and find new ways to bypass their parents' monitoring. But if you have more conversations about kind of the philosophy behind online sharing and expectations and good choices and things of that nature, I think that's a better approach.
I'll tell you the sweetest thing. My daughter... was on Twitter without my knowledge. She set up her own little Twitter account because I'm crazy about Twitter. And I got on her iPad and saw it. And I'd never had a conversation with her to not do it. But she had posted a Twitter account and used a little photo of the tooth fairy that I gave her. And I read through her Twitter feed and somebody had said something really mean about Barack Obama and told him to shut up. And she replied back saying, "That's not nice. You shouldn't say that to people." And then some famous singer, Selena Gomez, or somebody said, "I wake up and my hair's messed up." And my daughter replied saying, "You too? My hair's messed up when I wake up in the morning too." And I thought it was so sweet.
I'm just like Selena Gomez. And so am I.
Yeah.
I think I'm, among parents, I'm one of the more tech-savvy parents. I think all of us are probably more so than average. But there is no keeping up with this stuff.
I mean, never.
From a technology standpoint, there's just no... there are apps that look like other apps that hide things. I mean, if a kid really wants to get, real creative with how they're hiding their online behavior or whatever, it's... unless you become, like, Amish, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to completely control all that or monitor all that.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out how to hide my Grindr account.
Yeah, before your daughter found out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she posted, "My hair looks messy in the morning too."
All right, so our second article comes from fortune.com, and it highlights five things that people need to be happy at work. And the five things are: you need work that challenges you, a sense of progress, no fear, autonomy, and a sense of belonging.
Yeah, and these five things, I feel like I've read a version of this article multiple times over the last few years, but I mean, all of these are seem to me very true and practical things that you would need at work. I mean, being challenged, they say difficult but doable work. A sense of progress, I think that's tied together with that, you know, not having work where there's too much bureaucracy and red tape or email. having no fear so you can take risks in your work and be challenged. And autonomy is important. Having a sense of belonging with your coworkers. I agree with all those things.
And I think that's why I love where I work. Because when I go through that list, I have absolutely every single one of those except for the safety part. I'm very, very, very afraid.
But you could not have a sense of safety in
a closet.
Right, I was going to say. Or a,
that's an unrealistic expectation for you.
I wouldn't be safe in a safe room.
Right, yeah. In a concrete bunker.
Yeah, not safe.
Yeah. So, Rachel Kitson, are you happy at work?
Yes, I'm pretty happy.
Why are you happy at work?
Well, because I think I have these five things in addition to some other things, too. I mean, I think there's a lot of overlap here. You know, if you don't feel, you know, autonomous and a sense of belonging, you're probably going to feel very anxious and nervous at work. And so I think a lot of these are kind of well integrated. But I think having an environment like this really supports creativity and supports motivation. And, you know, people who are happy at work are going to work harder.
I think, too, the thing that's missing, at least for me on this list, that makes me happy at work is a sense of fun.
Yep, fun.
And that's, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we have here is a great sense of fun and a lot of joking and a lot of pranking and a lot of fun. And I was thinking, man, if we didn't have that, even if I had a sense of belonging and a sense of purpose, I'm not sure my work life would be nearly as satisfying or as happy.
I'd be very sad.
Scared and sad.
Scared. I mean, steady state scared and then sad.
That's his tramp stamp tattoo.
Scared and sad. How did you know? In Japanese symbols, right?
Celtic symbols.
Yeah, scared and sad. All right. I'm kind of going to have to do that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to join our trending topic, which is today, The Walking Dead and the fear of The Walking Dead. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen, along with Jonathan Hederle, Rachel Kitson, and Frank, formerly the Psych Weasel, Gaskell. And we're talking about The Walking Dead and Fear of the Walking Dead. On our previous iteration of this podcast, we actually talked about this before, but it's really timely because Fear of the Walking Dead just wrapped up, and The Walking Dead is launching for its fifth season. Sixth season. Oh, yeah, that's right. Man, they got away from me.
Oh, wow.
And it is still a phenomenon. In fact, I think the audience continues to grow with that show. So I know that Jonathan watches the show. Frank, you watch the show. Rachel, do you watch the show? And is that just out of, like, is that a decision that you've made not to watch it or just haven't got around to it?
No, I mean, I've heard things about it. I think you might have encouraged me at some point to watch it and it sounded interesting to me, but I don't know, seeing like zombies and people like eating each other, and I that's just something I don't need to see at night.
It's good eating.
Yeah.
You should watch it over breakfast.
Right. I should watch it in the morning. But I also don't have TV, so I'd have to
put that might be a limiting factor.
It's on Netflix.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Just finish up your Orange is the New Black. And
yeah,
then
so there's
start
a show that
Dead.
We should talk about. Yeah. I have no say here, obviously.
Lesbian
I'll watch,
sex
okay, I'll watch,
scenes,
I'll watch the
good.
Walking, I'll watch The Walking Dead if you guys watch Orange is the New Black. Deal?
Done. Deal.
Okay.
That's a deal.
Done.
For those of you who do watch the show, what is the appeal of it for you? I know we have talked about this a little bit in the past, but it is fascinating to think that we're watching this show about zombies and about people that are stuck in this zombie apocalypse. Why do we watch it for now 6 seasons?
Well, for me, first of all, it's just beautifully written and shot. Like the production values is incredible. And it's something that if you're a big horror film buff, you don't always see. But for me, they take it very seriously and they try to explore really serious, deep themes about humanity and survival and what stress and tension, you know, and having to make some hard moral choices, how people tend to respond and then the impact that it has on you.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great experience of being able to sit down and watch it and know that millions of other people are going to be watching it, and then you're able to come in the next day and just talk about it, and it's exhilarating to see it. And when I watch it, I don't think, oh, it's the zombies. I think it's the humans.
So it's kind of a water cooler event. Absolutely. It's one of the few things. It's like we still have in our culture a few things like football and Walking Dead that people talk about regularly when they get together.
This is such a male bias show. Yeah.
What is, yeah. Okay, what is a female equivalent of a show that people would watch, or an event that people would watch regularly?
Well, I mean, I think Orange is the New Black is a show that a lot of women watch. Girls, there's reality TV shows that women watch. I don't know. There are some unisex programs, mm-hmm. I feel like, that people all watch, but I would say
Glee,
football and Walking Dead. I've never seen Glee.
Well, and honestly, I'm not a horror buff. Like that doesn't really draw me in or attract me to have a following. If it wasn't for the characters, like if it wasn't for Rick and that crew, I would have bailed a long time ago. I care about what happens to them. I want to find out what happens to them and how this changes them or doesn't change them.
Let me ask Rachel this. I feel like I'm a evangelist for this show now. Did you watch Lost?
I started watching Lost.
Did you like it?
I enjoyed it. My husband didn't like it.
That's interesting. But I'll tell you my take on Walking Dead is that it's Lost with zombies. And the idea is you've got this group of people that find themselves in this world where they don't know what's going on. The rules are all different. And you don't know who to trust. And you have to make your way through this world. And it's the same basic premise as Lost, except with zombies, right? But I actually think, in many respects, it's a better show. Because I think where Lost ultimately fell down was they just threw everything against the wall to see what stuck. And they didn't really have a master plan, even though they kind of lied and said they did. This show clearly has a plan, and they're clearly going somewhere with it.
And I would love for you to watch this, because with your articles on Shrink Tank, for you to, I would devour any article you wrote about Walking Dead, because the psychology of this show is so deep and it's so intense around personalities. I mean, it's unbelievable. You'd have tons to write about.
Yeah, I actually...
300 words or less, though, for Frank.
Yeah, no. If every word you write about Walking Dead, I will read every single one.
Yeah, me too. I'm in.
Right. I'm in.
So you guys also watched Fear the Walking Dead.
Yes.
And what did you think of that show?
It's a slow burn that I really liked, that kind of, you know, you're going somewhere, and it also incorporates things that I hadn't really thought of how the kids and the teens are saying, no, really, I've seen it on the internet. There are these people and they get shot and they keep walking. And the parents are saying, that's ridiculous. The government would tell us, like, well, not really.
So what's the premise of Fear of the Walking Dead? How's that different?
Well, it kind of goes back to during the origins and the initial outbreak. And it kind of shows how society, in some ways, you have certain factions that are responding and they're alerted, and other people are kind of dismissing it and just saying, you know, like Frank said, that if there was something really happening, they'd be telling us. And it, to me, the show, I'm intrigued, but I'm not entirely sold. I do think it got a lot better as the season went on. But one of the things that Frank, you highlighted, is one of my frustrations, regardless of how realistic it might be, was that there were so many adults acting just incredibly stupid. I think in some ways, like, it sounds like they're smart parents, it sounds like they're decent good people, and yet they're it's almost like they're trying too hard to not to say the word zombie or outbreak, and just all these things that everybody,
it's in the collective experience of people before the outbreak
Neighbors are eating each other and they're like, Mom, what's going on? Like, go to your room. Like, I just don't see that happening.
I do, because
I'm an adult.
That's how I behave.
I'll tell you why. Dave and I were at Comic-Con, and we're standing 6 feet away from Hugh Jackman dressed as Wolverine. And I just kept saying, dude, you can make a lot of money dressed up as Wolverine. My brain would not allow me to believe that was Hugh Jackman.
Right.
And I don't think...
And just to put it in context, he was just walking around not as Hugh Jackman.
Right. As Wolverine. As
a guy at Comic-Con dressed up like Wolverine. So he's standing in front of you, and then we only found out later that it was really Hugh Jackman.
And so if I see this kind of stuff, I mean, I might believe it, but your average Joe, I don't think their brains will allow them to accept that as a reality. It will have to be coming up with other reasons that are more plausible.
Especially if you're trying to protect your kids or prevent them from being aware of what's going on.
Right.
So, Rachel, to make the point of what you were asking about, this Walking Dead, the original series, starts off with a guy waking up. He's been in a coma, and then the world's all different. And so all this stuff has happened. This show is set in a different location with different characters. So Walking Dead's in Atlanta. Fear the Walking Dead's in Los Angeles. But it's happening during the time he was in that coma.
Okay. Six weeks before the outbreak.
That's kind of cool, too. It shows the bicoastal.
Uh-huh. Right.
So have they gone to the middle of the country yet?
No,
the heartland?
Well, I'm not going to give a spoiler, but something happens in the last scenes of the last episode of Fear the Walking Dead that my brain exploded. Because it's going to allow...
Once again,
it's going to allow for us to experience the apocalypse in a way we've never experienced it. It's limitless possibilities now.
And I will say, again, without giving that away, because I'm sure there are a few people that have DVR'd this and not watched it by this point, is that this is in conversations about zombie apocalypse and The Walking Dead. This idea comes up a lot, but it's never been explored on the TV show.
We've never seen it.
What it does is it allows them to go almost anywhere they want to go, figuratively, literally, in some respects. So it takes the show in a completely different direction, mm-hmm. in a very cool way.
Yeah.
So you weren't sold on it because you felt like the motives for people were a little bit off.
I'll continue to watch it. I'm giving it a chance because it improved from the start, but... Yeah, I think the biggest difference for me is I haven't fallen in love with the characters. Like, even immediately, that first six season episode, or when The Walking Dead premiered, like, Rick and the crew, they immediately had me hooked. And these characters, I don't feel that same immediacy.
Frank, do you have a connection with them?
I do have a connection with them, but I also, what Heatherly's saying, I resonate with a little bit from that first episode. But I'm also easily... led down the path of I'll believe whatever you tell me.
Yeah. I think for me, I like the show. I'm with it. But I think there's this kind of metaphor of being a zombie and being an addict.
Mm-hmm.
And the strongest character, I think, is the kid who's the drug addict. I mm-hmm. think he's the strongest actor and the strongest character potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got to be real careful what they do with that guy, because they're kind of... they're moving into almost marginalizing that character, which might be an error in the calculus of where the show's going.
And even how they talk about getting him methadone, or it's like you've got to feed the kid. I mean, it's a neat analogy, and seeing that happen, it's my favorite show right now until season six starts.
Right. So one more question about this. This is... had some legs on it, probably longer than we imagined. If you thought back 6 years ago, this show is going to last six seasons and the audience is going to continue to build, you might be skeptical. But it looks like this show could go on for three more seasons, four more seasons.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine.
Longer than that.
But
what do you think, why does it have a shelf life, and what do you think the shelf life is? Like, why is it done so well? And do you think it will have an inevitable point where it's just going to be like, okay, we're all done. We're all saturated. Even if they're doing high quality work, we're done with this.
I think it'll happen. I don't know exactly when, but they've almost set themselves up for an inevitable, I don't want to say decline or crash, but people fall in love with these characters, and you are continuing to scale down and narrow down the original characters, but you live in this world where nobody is safe. And at some point, in order to in some ways navigate the realism that they've set themselves up for, like, they're going to have to continue to put the major central characters in harm's way, and some are going to die. And at some point, just as they keep replenishing it with new characters, I really like them, but they're not the same as Rick and Glenn and the central crew. And I think at some point when all of them are gone, the show will take, for at least for me, it'll be difficult to carry on with these characters from the very beginning like you did.
You had a sense early on, like within the first two or three episodes, that if Rick, Daryl, a couple of those key characters didn't continue on, that you weren't going to buy into the show. But there isn't that sense as strongly with Fear the Walking Dead yet. Yeah. So there's not that, after a six episode run or however it's been, there's not that sense of like, well, if this person died, then I'm out. So there is not, you're right, the connection isn't quite as strong.
Well, is that why they potentially built in the fear of the Walking Dead? Because they could see, I mean, it's apocalyptic, so there has to be an end. People are going to be waiting for that cathartic or whatever mm-hmm. moment. So is this side story a way to kind of keep up ratings, perhaps? Or
you mean between the two series?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're trying to work this to keep it fresh, but I also think they're trying to make them their own separate things.
Separate okay. worlds, and not kind of cross-pollinate to where you become so figurative in one. And
yeah, this is going to allow for exploration of the zombie apocalyptic world in a way that we haven't really seen before, which I think is exciting. I think they're doing it not just for ratings, I think that is at play, but they're expanding this sort of world that they've created. And I'd be shocked if these people have not sat down and said, okay, we need to talk about a 2-year arc of how do we wrap this thing up? Because I don't want to see it die.
Yeah, and I think they'll probably create a end date, and they'll be able to keep the quality high until then. Because I think similar to Game of Thrones, they already have source material that they can vet and they can learn from. These things, if we had to redo it, would we follow that same story arc? Like in the comics, Daryl's a very small character and he dies. And here they put him into a major, significant central character and he flourishes. And that's one of the huge appeals of this show, that they're able to learn from the source material.
Yeah, for sure. And
by the way, thanks for telling me he dies in the comics. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Frank's a very slow reader. So
he reads?
He hadn't gotten to that yet. I'll make another prediction too. And I think this might not just be a prediction, just that I am slow on the uptake of reading the other things that are out there. But there's a web series based on Fear the Walking Dead that's set on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And I am relatively certain that that is going to intersect the main series. I'm not 100% certain of that, but I think that is.
The Lost Cast will be on.
Yeah, then Jack.
Now to get real weird. Yeah.
So Sawyer. The Love Boat will show up. Is there any backstory on any of the zombies, or are they just totally nasty?
That is a side that has not been explored, unless it is someone that's been connected to, like, the early in the first season of Walking Dead, there's a man that is sitting in the window of upstairs of his house, and he's sighting zombies that are walking down the street with a high-powered scope. He's got a gun trained on them, and his wife is walking down the street, and he can't bring himself to pull the trigger. And so you don't know all of that story, but you have enough to know she had this life with him, and
right.
So there's a little bit of that, but it's not.
That'd be an interesting direction
yeah,
to go to.
Absolutely,
that could be a good one. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have a special topic that's related to this topic. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen, along with Jonathan Hederle, Frank the Psych Weasel, and I guess today our special guest, Rachel Kitson, who is sort of on the periphery of this conversation because she hasn't watched The Walking Dead. Are we closer to getting you to at least try it out?
I have tried it out. I just need to keep going with it.
Experimented with The Walking Dead in college.
Yeah. Did a little.
Well, along these lines, we've been talking about The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, and Frank and Jonathan and I are actually contributors to a relatively new book that just came out this year. It's edited by Travis Langley, and it's called The Walking Dead Psychology, Psych of the Living Dead. And it's available in Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all over the place. And it turned out really good. We're really pleased with it. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It takes aspects of The Walking Dead and explores the psychology behind it, the psychology of fear, the psychology of being a child who grows up in the apocalypse, the psychology of different character motivations and things like that. So first, Frank, let me ask you, when you were approached to do this, I know we all jumped on this pretty quickly, but what was the appeal of it for you? And then how did you come up with the idea for your chapter?
Well, the appeal of it was, I believe the first horror movie I ever saw was Night of the Living Dead. And I've probably watched it 70 or 80 times. Actually, our office manager went to the grave site where you see the first zombie, and actually her relative is on the tombstone. And we actually got to meet George Romero and hang out with him. And just this whole cult, the whole idea of a zombie apocalypse has always been exciting to me.
And what's your chapter about?
Well, I have to say it's chapter one.
Well.
And it happens to be about why we watch. It's entitled How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Zombie Apocalypse. And the sort of motive for me to write that was when I was trapped in a snowstorm in Philadelphia. And we were trapped in that apartment for several days. The National Guard came out. If you walked outside, the National Guard picked you up. It was a little scary. We didn't have power. And being in that huge apartment complex with all these people really changed the dynamic of the relationships that we had. I didn't know all these people. And by the end of that snowstorm, we were playing chess. We were talking to each other. We're cooking for each other. And that external stressor coming in, forcing people to bond and connect, really made sense to me.
Jonathan, how about you? What was first the appealing thing about being part of this? And then also, how did you come to pick the chapters or the segments that you wrote?
Sure. I just wanted to get connected with some folks that were thinking on this level about the show, that loved the show, but also didn't just take it at face value. And it's interesting that I actually reached out to Travis at one point. I wasn't originally a part of the book, and said, hey, if ever you guys do a sequel or other projects, I'd love to be considered. And he actually got back in touch with me and said, would you be interested in doing maybe one or two case files, sort of the smaller chapters within a chapter. And he reached out and communicated this like 2 days before I was about to go on vacation with my family to Universal Studios. And so naturally I said, sure, what do you want me to do? And so we kind of went back and forth and selected a couple of topics. And within 48 hours, I had kind of sent rough drafts. And then even over once or twice during the week, I was down in Orlando, got some edits and sent them back and forth. But I just really wanted to not only be a part of it, but read and just kind of see what other psychologists and those that are in this field think about The Walking Dead.
And tell us about your chapters.
I did a case file with Travis on the governor, and we look at some of his Machiavellian traits, and we looked at like his charm and manipulation or power and competition, and just some of the ways that you see his sociopathic or just sort of the evil in some ways that the governor exhibits throughout his time on the show. And then I did one on the Claimers, the group that Daryl runs into after the prison is overrun, and how there's this group that really go back to almost primitive ways of law and order where you claim something. And in a lot of ways, any type of offense is really a lot of times the consequence is death.
And let me just comment on you talking about working with Travis, that we've worked with Travis on this project and then a couple others coming up, and he's working on a number of books that are part of this series of psychology and pop culture.
Did you say Star Wars?
I did not.
Well, I thought I heard it.
Well, no, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
That might be part of the series. And I'll just say this is a Herculean effort that he has undertaken.
Incredible.
So he's done a tremendous job just with the pulling this together and wrangling all these different writers. I think, you know, there's something like 19 writers or something like that involved in this one book. And then there's others involved with other books. And just to keep everybody, you know, kind of herded and moving and corral everything has just been really remarkable to see. But as a result, it's a good product. And the chapter that I wrote is called Shock and Dread. We'll play on Walking Dead.
Wait, what?
Shock and Dread, What Fear Does to Humans.
Huh. I don't get it, but okay.
Yeah, it's okay. You're not very, very smart.
Right.
So, and what I really talked about is not only the physiology and the kind of autonomic reactions that humans have, but also the psychology of fear and how psychology comes into play when people are faced with their own mortality. And I talked about something that's called terror management theory, which is kind of fascinating about how people, when they get reminded of their own mortality and that they're going to die, become more invested in their legacy and in a way of thinking and a way of life, and they dig into it even harder as a way of sort of preserving themselves. And there's some data that supports that and some research that supports that, but it's kind of fascinating stuff. But it's a good book. We hope you guys will check it out. Well, we're going to wrap it all up with our doctor's orders, and these are things that we're personally enjoying in popular culture. And Rachel, thank you for indulging us with this.
Certainly.
And do you have something that you have been personally enjoying lately?
I've been really enjoying Ryan Adams' cover of Taylor Swift's 1989.
Yes.
I think it's awesome.
I do too.
He takes it and makes his own. I mean, it stands on its own as a great album.
Even though you robbed me of my doctor's order, I'm so happy you said that because I love it. I really do.
It's great. It's interesting too how he's, by doing this album, has put Taylor Swift on sites like Pitchfork and things like that, where, you know, these are kind of more snobby sites that wouldn't, you know, talk about Taylor Swift in the past. And so it's sort of bringing her into that arena.
I thought her voice on the album was fantastic. Yeah.
Frank, how about you?
My doctor's orders is run, do not walk, to see The Martian. It is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
If you don't see it on the big screen, you have missed out on an experience. And be sure to check out Jonathan Hederle's article on shrinktank.com. It is a great insight into the film.
Speaking of Jonathan Hederle.
Yeah, my doctor's orders would be the second season of Fox's The Last Man on Earth is airing, and I think it's a great show. I laugh a lot. I really enjoy it. They've scaled back the first two episodes and really focused on the two central characters, but it looks like the premise and some of the characters that were in the first season are coming back, and you can follow my reviews of each episode on shrinktank.com.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Shrink Tank Talk or like us on Facebook by searching for Shrink Tank. And of course, you can check us all out on shrinktank.com, where you'll find articles about all kinds of things that are cool in pop culture related to psychology. Our engineer and audio wizard is Zach Brown. For Rachel Kitson, Jonathan Hederle, and Frank Gaskell, I'm Dave Verhagen. Have a great week.